We're continuing our study tonight in the book of 1 Peter in chapter 3, and we're ready to delve into verses 10 through 12 in our study, and we will go ahead and start with reading that. He says, "For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips that they speak no guile. Let him eschew evil and do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil." And those words should sound pretty familiar to us, very familiar to us. They're not found only here in the book of 1 Peter. He's quoting from the Old Testament scriptures, namely the book of Psalms. And in Psalm 34, which we want to go to in shortly in our study, Lord willing, to see what he was teaching about there, and see how he's using that same teaching here in 1 Peter 3 in this context. But we can see in verse 10 that he starts with this word "for," and that shows a connection to what he was just saying prior to it. And then he continues after verse 12 saying "and." So we have conjunctions before and after the quotation from Psalm 34. And what we see immediately preceding that quotation and immediately following it is a continuation of the context, really, of the book of 1 Peter, the main context. What is the subject that we see every single chapter at length, not just a mention, but teaching at length in every chapter of this book? About suffering for righteousness' sake. So these sufferings that he refers to as having glory to it, as opposed to the other kind of suffering, which is being buffeted for one's faults when one is suffering the consequences of their wrong actions, which is referred to as the chastening of the Lord in Hebrews chapter 12, which is a necessary type of suffering, but not glorious. It's not glorious to be chastened, to be punished for wrongdoing. But the kinds of sufferings that he's speaking about or teaching about in this book is suffering for doing what is right in the sight of the Lord, for being persecuted or suffering for obeying the commandments of God. Now, those two kinds of suffering that are contrasted, that goes back to chapter 2, where he says in verses 19 and 20, as we've pointed out, the word "thankworthy" and the word "acceptable" in these two verses is the Greek word "charis" for grace or favor. But he says, "This is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God." So this is the kind of suffering that is the subject of this book, this kind that brings glory when we endure the sufferings for doing what is right in the sight of God, which is suffering wrongfully. It is wrong to for someone to cause us to suffer for doing what is good in God's sight, for keeping his commandments. But when we are suffering for that and we endure it, that is, we continue to obey the Lord and keep his commandments, then there's great glory in that. And he first started teaching on that in chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. Part of the glory that follows that suffering is what in 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7? What happens when we endure those sufferings? Yeah, and he speaks about the process of our purification in our inner man. 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7 says, "Wherein You greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So there's that glory again. But what is part of that glory here? When our faith is found in a certain fashion at the appearing of Christ, well, what fashion is that? Purified. And what purifies our faith? It's the heat of those temptations that come through those trials on our faith, those persecutions, those tribulations. And so that's how our faith is purified. That's how the impurities are removed. So this is part of our spiritual growth. So with each trial in our faith, each temptation that we face because we've done the Lord's will, so we've heard his word and we believe what he says, because that's where faith comes from, hearing his word. And then when we believe not just in our minds, but have that living faith, that faith that obeys him and keeps his commandments. So when we do his will that we've heard out of our faith, well, then we're going to be tested in that. That faith will be tested, and we're going to have temptations. And very often that's going to come through tribulation. And when that comes, well, we have a choice then, don't we, in that tribulation? Do we continue to do God's will, continue to obey that commandment that we've started to obey, that we understand and believe in, that we've heard from his word? Or under that temptation, do we give in to it and then we stop obeying that commandment? And that can either be just by our quitting, it can be by our rebelling against the temptation and refusing to suffer that persecution, but instead of doing what is good and right and obeying the Lord towards the ones who are persecuting us, if we do evil to those who do evil to us, have we endured the temptation, or have we fallen and failed the test? That's failure, not endurance. But when we do endure all that and continue to do God's will, continue to obey all the commandments he gives us that he's taught us to do under those circumstances, then we're growing more in the image of Christ. We're walking in his footsteps then, and we're becoming more like him. And as that happens, well, is that glorious? What is the hope of glory? Christ in you. That's Colossians 1, verse 27. So he uses that word glory to describe this process of our growing in the image of Christ over and over again in the scriptures. So this is part of that glory that comes from this kind of enduring, this kind of suffering for righteousness' sake. So those are the footsteps of Christ. That's the example that he set for us. So as we see that subject in chapter 1, we see it in chapter 2. So when he speaks of that endurance of persecutions and the sufferings for doing what is right in God's sight in 1 Peter 2, 19 and 20, what did verse 21 tell us? We've been called to do that. For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. All right, then it describes those steps. What he's calling us to do, he did. Did he suffer for righteousness' sake? I mean, how much? Was he reviled? Did he suffer? He did. And it says in verse 22, who did no sin. So all the temptations that Christ suffered in his life in going through those persecutions that he did, how many times did he fail? Never. Not once. So he did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. And that should sound familiar with what he's going back to here in chapter 3, what we just read in verses 10 through 12. So Christ had no guile in his mouth, as he teaches us in 1 Peter 3 and verse 10, to refrain our tongue from evil and our lips that they speak no guile. Well, who's the example of that? Christ is. And so he did, there was no guile found in his mouth. When he was reviled, what did he do? He reviled not again. So as he tells us to refrain our tongue from evil, did Jesus do that? He refrained his tongue from evil. He didn't revile back, and there was no guile found in his mouth. So these very words he's taking from Psalm 34 and teaching us to have, Christ had that. And he's pointing that out there in chapter 2. And then as we continue on in verse 23, when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. So he had his trust in his Father. Did he strike out against those who were doing evil to him? No. Who did he entrust to bring him through those temptations and to take care of the judgment of all of those things? His Father. And we're told to do the same thing, as we noted when we were in chapter 2. He tells us the very same thing at the end of chapter 4 in verse 19, wherein he says, "Wherefore let him them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator." He's teaching us to do exactly what Christ did. All right, well, what was in Christ? What did he have that enabled him to have that kind of trust for in his Father, and also to be able to go through all of the sufferings that he did, being that man of sorrows? And is there anyone that is, we read in the old, when we think of suffering, we think of people who suffer in the Bible. Who comes to mind? All right, who do we think of from the Old Testament that's associated with suffering? Job. I mean, that he comes right to mind, doesn't he? And not only Job, of course. I mean, what about all the prophets and, I mean, all the righteous? That's part of the process. And we see those examples in the Old Testament, and that's why Hebrews 11 gives us so many of those as our great cloud of witnesses to encourage us in running our race, because we've got to go through the same things. But we particularly think of Job in the Old Testament. That's probably the one that comes to our mind first. And as far as suffering, we see what all the things that Job went through. Well, who suffered more for righteousness' sake, Job or Christ? I mean, there's no comparison. Christ did, and far greater than any of us ever will. And he got through every one of those temptations and didn't fall to one of them. Never. What did he have in him that could get him through every one of those? Because if what he had got him through it, and we're to walk in his steps, then that very same thing can be in us and get us through it too, can't it? Well, what is that? Well, that's what he's teaching us. He described it in chapter 2 in those verses that are telling us about his footsteps, that we can see match up it precisely with what we just read in 1 Peter 3, 10 through 12 that we're supposed to do. And the context is the same. What did he just say in chapter 3, verse 9? Not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing. And again, he's using the same words that he used concerning Christ, teaching us to follow in those steps. But that's when we're suffering for doing what's right, isn't it? So that's the subject here. Not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrarywise blessing, knowing that you're thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. Well, then what does he say in verse 13? And who is he that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good, but, and if you suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you, and be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. So immediately before that quotation in verses 10 through 12, what is he teaching about? And then right afterwards, which shows us this is the context of what the quotation is about. And that's suffering for righteousness' sake and how to overcome those temptations in that. And what he says in verses 10 through 12 is what we need to get us through it. And it's what Christ had that got him through it. And what is that? That's the fear of the Lord. He's quoting from Psalm 34 that teaches us the fear of the Lord. Before we go to Psalm 34 to look at that, the description of Christ that we have in Hebrews chapter 1, this is describing that fear of the Lord that he had, that we also saw there in 1 Peter 2. He kept his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. Well, what was in Christ? Hebrews chapter 1 and verses 8 and 9. Hebrews 1, 8 and 9. This is also a quotation from Psalms, which was a prophecy of Christ and his nature. And this is a fulfillment of that, describing that nature of Christ that fulfilled that prophecy in Psalms. But he says, "But unto the Son he saith, Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows." What did Jesus have in him in verse 9? A love for righteousness and a hatred of iniquity. Well, what is it to love righteousness and hate evil? I mean, that's the fear of the Lord. So that's what he's teaching about there in that quotation in 1 Peter 3, 10 through 12. If we're going to overcome temptation when we do what's right in God's sight and then we're persecuted for it, well, how much love for righteousness do we have to continue to do what's right when we're being persecuted for it? We can't just have a little bit of a mild fondness for righteousness to get us through those things, can we? We have to love it. And if we're going to get through all the temptations, I mean, how much do we have to love righteousness? Well, loving what is right is to love the one who is right and who is the definer of righteousness, isn't it? And what is the great commandment? To love God with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength. So how much love for righteousness do we have? It needs to be full with all of our being. And Christ had that. Well, we have to have that if we're going to get through all the temptations that we're going to face and overcome through all the trials in our faith in our lives. And by the same token, we have to have that same hatred for evil when we love righteousness. You can't love righteousness and really not mind iniquity too much at the same time, can you? I mean, if you love what's right, what are you going to do with what's not right? If you don't really hate what's evil, then do you really love what's right? Those are opposite things. And so there's no mixing of that two. There can't be. So we have to love righteousness and hate evil. Well, how much do we have to hate evil to resist the temptation to do evil when we are being persecuted for righteousness' sake? It should not be difficult for us to see how essential and important the fear of the Lord is for us to have. That's what Christ had. He loved righteousness, hated iniquity, and did that get him through those temptations? It did. All of them. And we need to have that in us. And that's what he's teaching here in 1 Peter 3, 10 through 12, where he is quoting from Psalm 34. Before we go to that Psalm 34. In Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 13, he makes a statement about the fear of the Lord. There are a number of passages in the scriptures, of course, that teach that subject. Proverbs 8:13 says, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate." That's God's wisdom speaking. So does God hate evil? Yes. What did we just read about Christ? He hated evil. What is the fear of the Lord? He says the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. So that is a major part of the fear of the Lord is hating iniquity, but as we also saw, that having that love for righteousness must go along with that. Loving righteousness, hating evil. Psalm 34, so let's go there now. And we've looked at this many times before, but since he's quoting from it in 1 Peter 3, this we wouldn't be doing the study right if we didn't go back and read the original that he's quoting from. Psalm 34. Now, it's interesting in this, you're probably already mentally going down to verse 11 where it starts about come and I will teach you the, hearken, children, and come and I'll teach you the fear of the Lord. But even before that, he teaches about the fear of the Lord, and he says in starting in verse 6, this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. All right, so is this this is being a psalm of David. Well, did David have any troubles? And we think of those who suffer for righteousness' sake. Yes, Job comes right to mind, but what about David? How many people in the Bible do we have as much information about their persecutions and their sufferings for righteousness' sake as much as we do with David? Not many. I mean, you could put Job up there, David, but as far as just having the details, I mean, he is one of the ones that God holds out to us as a chief example of this. Well, he had troubles, and so he says this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. So how many of the temptations that David faced through all of his persecutions, how many of those did he overcome? Well, we're told in the scriptures there's only one situation in David's life where he turned from the commandments of God. David fully obeyed the Lord and overcame all of his temptations. 1 Kings 15, verse 5 says, because David did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord and turned not aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, save only in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And yes, there was a lot in that matter. We have psalms and teachings about that. And also how David, after that failure, how he did not fail again. And he says that there in 1 Kings 15:5. So when we're looking at the life of David, other than that one very serious matter, other than that, though, what do we see of his life? Success or failure in battling temptation? We see success, and he overcame them. In all of the, he didn't turn aside from any of God's commandments. How many of us can say that? We're not going to measure up very well with that record, are we? Well, what's the important thing now? Can we end up in the same place? Yeah, that's the real key. That's why we're studying this. I mean, what can we do about yesterday? Or anything that's happened before? I mean, we can't do anything about that, but what can we do something about? We can do something about what we're facing now and whatever the Lord, it's his will for us to face from this point onward. And we have the roadmap in how to succeed and overcome those temptations. Well, David is a major part of that roadmap, but he had this fear of the Lord. Because when he says that this poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles, is that showing how God got David through those persecutions and all those temptations to where he did overcome all of them, except in that one matter? Yes. And what was it that David had that got him through all of that? Same thing that Christ had, then we must have. And that's the fear of the Lord. As he says in verse 7, the angel of the Lord encamps round about them that fear him and delivereth them. That's encouraging, isn't it? Now, does the Bible teach that each Christian has a personal guardian angel? No, but how many angels does the Lord have? Well, we don't know the exact number, but he multiplies thousands upon thousands when he speaks of them in the book of Revelation, which, what's 1,000 times 1,000? That's 1,000,000. So when you have thousands times thousands, I mean, you're in the millions. So the Lord uses that kind of number in describing that host. He has a host of those faithful servants that just are doing nothing. For some reason, there's some people that get upset when... if we speak about God working and using his angels in his work, is that a miraculous thing for God to work and for God to... I mean, miracles are one type of work of God, but his, as we've studied about God working in the nations and ruling this world, is he doing it? Is he running it by miracles, or is he working in everything and ruling? I mean, it's not a miraculous reign. That's not the kind of works that's describing his ruling this universe. Well, when he's exercising his dominion over all the nations, does he use the angels in his work? Does he give them tasks? That's what he's done. We read it in the Bible. That's what he's always done. Did he quit that? Did he retire the angels? Put millions of them on retirement and they're doing nothing now? I mean, how foolish is that thought? No, they're not retired. They're still working from what God tells them. In fact, when we read about when the end of the world comes, Christ is going to come with what? And whom? He's going to have his mighty angels with him when he comes to end this world. I mean, they're not going to just suddenly unretire at that moment and show up with Christ and do something. I mean, the Lord's using them in his work now. Well, he's describing his use of, the angel of the Lord encamps round about them that fear him. Is God watching over our souls, not allowing us to be tempted above what we're able to bear? Is he providing a way of escape through every temptation? Is he finding a way to deliver us if we are seeking for that way through each temptation? Does he use his angels to help? I mean, when Christ was suffering there in the garden, who did the Father use at that moment to give him strength? He says, the angel. Well, was that a miracle? No. I mean, if we weren't told about it, would anybody have been able to see that? No, which means that couldn't be a miracle. It wasn't something observable. A miracle, by definition, is observable, and that's what it's for, is to be observed. When God was revealing his word by the ones who were hearing it, to know that that was his word being spoken by whichever prophet the Lord was inspiring. But strengthening Christ when he was praying alone in the garden, that was not a miraculous strength. And what would it mean to us if God provided some miraculous way for Christ to get through his temptations, but we don't have that? How could we follow in his steps then? There would be different steps. He would have gone one way, we would have to be going another. There would be no example to follow then, but we do have his example to follow. Well, does the Father use, what does he have at his disposal to get us through whatever it is that we're facing? He has all of that at his disposal, and including his angels, but however he's going to use them, we don't see it. But however God gives us the strength and gets us through it, will he do so? What is the condition in Psalm 34, verse 7? That we fear him. I mean, how is he going to help us through it if we don't love righteousness and hate iniquity? We won't be able to get through that then. But with that, we can get through it. We can overcome. And then in verse 8, he says, "O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. O fear the Lord, ye his saints, for there is no want to them that fear him." Well, if that's what God's doing for the ones who fear him, what should we do? He says, fear him. There's no lack to them who fear him. This is the condition for all of this. Well, what do we have to do to be complete and entire, lacking nothing? That's what James chapter 1, verse 4 says. That's the end point of our letting patience have a perfect work, that patience that comes through enduring those tribulations and sufferings for righteousness' sake. What do we have to get through that? Well, if we're to count it all joy, we fall into divers temptations, knowing this, that the trying of our faith works patience, and let patience have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. And he says that there is no want to them that fear him. What's the condition for getting through all of those trials on our faith? We've got to fear him. He's hitting this over and over again when he's describing this Old Testament and New Testament. Well, is this pathway of hearing God's word and believing that and then having our faith tried and having to be face tribulations and temptations and then to overcome them and to grow spiritually, is that a process that did not exist, that God was not using with his children in the Old Testament? He was. I mean, that's why we have the examples of Job and David and all the prophets, all those righteous ones. Again, if that was not something that they had to go through, then how could they be a great cloud of witnesses to encourage us in running our race? So this is not a new thing that God uses this process. It's also not a new thing that having the fear of the Lord is the basis of our overcoming temptations that come through persecution. We have to love righteousness and hate iniquity. So it's always been that way, and it continues to be that way. That's why he's teaching that here in this passage that we're reading in Psalm 34 and many other passages in the Old Testament, as well as the New Testament. There's a reason that he's quoting from this. Is this Old Testament law, is this law of Moses that he's quoting here? No, this isn't the law of Moses. This is God's work. Now, of course, the commands that they had to obey, would that involve, during this time, such as David, would that have involved commandments that were under that law? Yes, but the process was not tied specifically just to that law. This process of spiritual growth and having to have the fear of the Lord to overcome temptation, that was not tied to the particular covenant. So it worked under the old covenant. Does it also work under the new? It does. And so here in Psalm 34, then, when we get to verse 9, or verse 10, he says, "The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing." Then we get verse 11, so that he's been building up to this. He doesn't just start mentioning the fear of the Lord here in verse 11. He's already been showing the necessity and the importance of it getting through our trials and temptations. But in verse 11, he says, "Come, ye children, hearken unto me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." Well, he's just said, here's what we have to have, and fear the Lord. Well, isn't the natural question that would come next, well, what is that, and how do we do it? And that's why he says, now come and I'll teach it to you. You've got to have it, but now here, listen, and I will teach you about it. So verse 12, what man is he that desireth life and loveth many days? I know we pointed out before, but if you put the question mark right after the word days there, and if it said, what man is he that desireth life and loveth many days? The answer to that question would be very different than the answer to the question as it is phrased here that includes that last part, that he may see good. Because if it just says, what man is he that desireth life and loveth many days? Well, that's another way of asking, who wants to live a long time? How many people are wanting to sign up for a long life on this earth? That's not unique to Christians, is it? The reason why we want to be here had better be entirely different than the reason people in the world want to be here. Why do people in the world want to stay here? They love it. This is what they love, and they don't want to leave what they love. Isn't that what it boils down to? I mean, this is what their heart is after, and this is where their affection is. And so they want to stay here. Do they want to go into eternity where they don't have all these things they love? They don't want to go there. They want to stay right here. How many people, if they were offered, well, you could. Some of these rich people even do crazy things to try to prepare. They're hoping that someday that they'll be. I mean, they're freezing their heads and things like. Some of them do this called cryogenics, where they think at some point that there's going to be somebody that science is going to figure out how to overcome the aging process, where that you can actually stay here, live here. that somehow the scene will become eternal, which will never happen. But there, some of them are hoping for it, and so they've preserved themselves, frozen some of these people, thinking that's going to happen at some point. It's not. But what does that show about what they love? I mean, if you offered people in this world that they could live here eternally on this earth, how many of them would say yes? How many would say, if you offered them, you can live forever here or leave here and go to heaven? How many would say, I want to go somewhere else, versus how many would say, I'll just stay right here? There would not be many that would say, I want to go somewhere else. It's because people love this world, which is what we've been called out of. So the reason why we want to be here is not because, well, we just love it here. Does anybody come to mind that just loved this world and then ended up, as an example, we have one of the shortest verses in the New Testament that says, remember Lot's wife. Well, what do we remember about her? Well, when coming out of Sodom and Gomorrah, that God was going to destroy by for its wickedness, they were told not to look back. Why did she look back? I mean, that's where your treasure is where your heart will be also. Where was her heart? It was in Sodom and Gomorrah. She loved it. And she was sorry to have to leave. Now, Lot, in contrast, we're told in 2 Peter 2 that the deeds of the people there, it vexed his righteous soul daily. He hated it. But he was married to a woman who loved it. And then when they came out, she looked back and was turned into that pillar of salt. Well, there's a warning. That's why Jesus said, remember Lot's wife. And no man who set his hand to the plow can look back. Well, we've been called out of this world to come out from it, not to love it, but rather to love and to seek what is eternal, the unseen things. Well, that's what is good. And so our desire for life and to love many days is so we can see good. Is he talking about seeing good happen in the world? Where do we see what is good? Well, he just said it in verse 10. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing. Where are we going to find the good, to see the good? At seeking the Lord, where do we seek him? Where do we find that he tells us what is good? Right here in his word. Now, how many of us can say, well, I've lived long enough now, I've seen it all. And I've learned all I can learn out of this book. So I'm not going to see any more if I live any longer. Well, of course, if we really believe that and say that, we're likely giving the Lord plenty of reason not to keep us around. But, I mean, what do we know if we love what's right and we love what's good? When we study God's word, do we ever do so in vain and not learn anything from it? Do we not see some more good? There's good in here that we're not seeing yet, isn't there? Does that bother us? That there's good that the Lord has to reveal to us that we can know and understand and follow, but we haven't seen it yet. That we shouldn't like that, to remain that way. So there we would have that hunger and thirst for righteousness and to seek him with all of our heart, to seek this treasure here. That's all part of this fear of the Lord. I mean, that's the first part here, is for us to love righteousness so much that, I mean, that's our desire for being here. So we can see more of the Lord's good so we can do it. There's a lot more to learn. I don't want to be taken away from this life without knowing all the Lord's will to be able to do that. I mean, shouldn't that be the way we believe and why we want to live? I mean, that should be our purpose for living, to see the good so we can do the good. What is that good from there? Now, what good is it to see it if we don't do it? It's not something just to view. What is the glory of the New Testament in 2 Corinthians 3:18? Well, we can don't leave Psalm 34. Just a quick dash out of there, so we can dash back. But 2 Corinthians 3 verse 18, when he's teaching about the glory of the New Testament, says, "But we all with open face." Beholding, is that seeing? That's the word for seeing. Beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord. Well, are we seeing good when we see his glory? I mean, when we see his glory to his full image, I mean, that's when we see all of the good, when we can see all of the parts of his nature, his love. We need to behold that, and he's showing us that in his word. But it's not just to see it. What's the next part that follows? He says, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. So the point of seeing it is so we can do it, to see what he's like, to see that good, to do that good, and be like the source of that good, to be a partaker of the same image. So then there's where he goes to the next points there, starting in verse 13, keep thy tongue from evil and thy lips from speaking guile. Well, that is the hardest job that we have, to bridle our tongues. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. So if we have evil in our hearts, it's going to come out of our mouths. So we've got to purge that out. And we've got to keep our tongue from evil and our lips from speaking guile. Now, when we're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, is that easy, or can that be difficult? That can be quite difficult. But what did he tell us about Christ? When he was reviled, he reviled not again. He did not speak any guile, which is what he teaches us and why he's quoting this in 1 Peter 3. In our sufferings for righteousness' sake, we have to do this. Verse 14, depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Well, if we love righteousness and hate evil, we see the good. What are we going to do with that good that we see? Do it. What about if we hate the iniquity? What are we going to do with that? Depart from it. Now, are we going to do that when we're being persecuted for doing so? Well, if we have this fear of the Lord and we love righteousness and hate iniquity, that's what we'll do. And seek peace and pursue it. And ultimately, that's going to be peace with whom? That's going to be peace with God. That peace with God comes by loving Him and doing His will. And then He gives us that promise after that in verse 15 that the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous and His ears are open unto their cry. And when are we going to be crying to Him the most? When we're in need? Is that going to be when we are facing tribulations? I mean, how does He describe Christ in Hebrews 5, verse 7? With strong crying and tears, He prayed for His Father to save Him from death. Well, and the Father heard Him in that He feared. So it was not saving Him from physical death because He heard it, which means He granted the request. He saved Him from spiritual death. He got Him through all those temptations. If Jesus had fallen to one of them, He would have died spiritually. And He was praying earnestly with that strong crying and tears to His Father to save Him from that, to get Him through all of those temptations. Well, when we are crying to Him in those circumstances, is He watching out for us? Is His ear open to our cry then? He says, yes, He promises that. And He says, the face of the Lord is against them that do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. The righteous crying, the Lord heareth and delivereth them out of all their troubles. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart and saveth such as be of a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. Well, that is exactly the point that he's teaching on, as we can see how that's tied in its original context in Psalm 34 to facing tribulation for righteousness' sake. And that's certainly the context here in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12, where he quotes from it. So we do need to love life to see good days, good in our days, and refrain our tongue from evil and our lips from speaking guile. Eschew evil and do good. Seek peace and ensue it. And he says there in verse 12, quoting from that Psalm 34, that the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous and His ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. So we don't want to be doing any evil and have the Lord's face against us. We need to be doing what's right through all of our the temptations that come upon us when we are doing the Lord's will, and continue to do that will and not fall to any of those temptations, so that we can have the Lord on our side working with us and not to be against us. Because if we quit doing His will when we're suffering for righteousness' sake, and that's what we end up doing. I mean, will the Lord turn His face against us if we refuse to endure grief, suffering wrongfully? He would. So we don't want that to happen. Well, we have that great promise of the Lord being with us if we will fear Him. All right, well, we're really out of time, so Lord willing, we'll pick it up from verse 13 next Wednesday, the Lord willing. But sure do appreciate everybody being here tonight for our study. Brother Dave, you're our song leader. Brother Jim, you have our closing prayer tonight.